Welcome to today's episode of Tatukiyo, the podcast for geography and GIS lovers, brought to you from the Department of Geography of the University of Tartu. The show is hosted by your favorite host, myself Tahmin, and Alex. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Tahmin. We also have a new student team member we'd like to let you know about. Her name is Sonia, and she will get more active as her study time allows. Hi, Sonia.
Hi, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to be a part of this podcast. And yes, hopefully you'll see me more as the semester, like the studies are less and I have more time. Thank you.
Excellent.
This podcast episode is made possible with the support of Grant PSG841 from the Estonian Research Council. Thank you very much.
For today's episode, we talk with Lisette Luik, who is the co-founder of Arbonix. With Arbonix, Lisette is building the new forest economy to help landowners realize the positive climate impact and value of their land. Arbonix work ensures that all the benefits of forests are being appreciated, from timber to carbon sequestration and biodiversity, while working towards afforestation and the impact forestry. Hi, Lisette. Welcome to today's show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Lisette, can you please introduce yourself a little bit and Arbonix for our listeners? How was your journey towards Arbonix? How you came with the plans and everything?
Sure, absolutely. So I have to start with a confession, which is that I am not a geographer by training, unfortunately. So you are all much smarter on that topic than I am. I actually studied economics. But my background is in a couple of startups one bigger corporate, and then finally investing on the venture side. But ultimately, I finally found what I really, really wanted to do about 2 years ago when I met my now co-founder, Christian. We were both working in an investment firm, and we started looking into forest investments and really thinking about, are forests fully being appreciated for all of the layers of value they bring? So we all know that timber is valuable, but you know, what about the carbon storage potential of forests? What about the biodiversity? And we started exploring this topic originally from the perspective of a landowner, because we were buying forest land into our portfolio at the time, and ultimately came to the conclusion that we were far from the only landowner to have these questions, and that there was a space for someone to come and help solve this and really help landowners contribute to climate by storing more carbon on their land through planting new forests and changing the way they manage their existing forests. And that was the birth of Arbonix. Arbonix is all about using data and particularly a GIS-based application to help landowners figure out what the carbon storing potential of their land is and where and what kind of forests they should be planting.
Cool.
Yes, I like you somewhat answered my question, but I still wanted to ask is that this entrepreneurship is like a journey. So were there other ideas that you had in mind and that you didn't commit to it as much as what you are doing with Arbonix? And how did you like finally said that, okay, this is where I'm going to invest my time. This is my passion. I found it.
Absolutely. I think I've known that I wanted to eventually go into entrepreneurship for like 15-ish years now, since pretty much when I was in high school. But I never really believed that I had the right skill set and that I didn't think I had the right idea. So that's what kind of took me to work in a couple of different startups in different stages. You know, I worked in like a three-person company, etc. I had a variety of other ideas over the years, none of which I thought was interesting enough to want to spend 10 years of my life on. I think the only one outside of Arbonix that got a little bit more traction was actually a data analytics solution for small e-commerce retailers. I built a prototype for that while I was doing my master's in the US, but then I came to realize that as interesting as it was, I didn't feel enough about this to want to really, you know, dedicate 24/7 to it for years and years. And I think the thing that finally made me take the plunge with Arbonix was that it was this really interesting intersection of impact and potential scale of business. So the positive climate impact, but also we really believe this could be a really interesting, scalable technology business. And that those things are quite rare in one, you know, in one idea.
Thanks. That's really cool, actually. And I think young people nowadays, and you are certainly also young, but also our students have more and more that they want to early, quickly do a job where they also have impact. And obviously, the climate crisis upon us, and just doing something for work is often not enough. Also for geography students, many geography students want to start and do something. You know, they come to geography because they have this people, nature, you know, and make the world a better place. That's excellent. We have heard from you now that you've also worked in the US and in the UK also. Is that right? How similar,
yes, that's right,
or how different is the work culture? For example, we feel that, you know, people in Estonia give you quite direct and honest feedback, and this is quite varying across regions and cultures. Now we have this international curriculum also, and so we have a bit of you know, the variety of cultural backgrounds who deal differently with this type. So and at first, you know, a person might not always appreciate honest feedback, but you know, often enough one would realize that it can also be useful. What is your experience, or what are your experiences, and what is maybe something that stand out in terms of those experience for each of the regions where you've been working and living?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I definitely see this issue, and I think Estonians are known as blunt in general, and I am particularly a very blunt Estonian. So I've certainly had the feedback myself, you know, over my career of, you know, you might want to tone it down a little bit. But what's really interesting is comparing the US, the UK and Estonia, I would say there's like a hierarchy. So when I was working in London for American Express, which is obviously a big US company, my team was, half the team was in London and half was in New York. And one of the main issues the New York team would give us, you know, an annual, we were doing feedback both directions, and they would tell us, oh, we feel like the London people are so, they're so direct and so blunt, and they're not, you know, like optimistic enough. And that was considered just, I don't think we said anything particularly strong. It's just that kids are used to everything is amazing and brilliant. And they just use a lot of more, I would say, coded language. You know, if they say, oh, that's interesting, they might mean this is terrible. Stop what you're doing.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm going to just say this is terrible. So yeah, I would find the US were sort of the most careful with their words, and I would say the least blunt. And then the British, who I think actually are kind of similar to Estonians in our some culture, but obviously have this, I would say, much thicker veneer of politeness over everything. So they couch their direct feedback in lots of really nice small talk, which Estonians are less likely to do. And then, yes, just say it how it is, for better and for worse.
Yeah.
But I think the other, I mean, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I think the other interesting culture difference is obviously, you know, the intensity of work and how people view what they think about work in the context of their broader life. And I, you know, living in London, working in London is a very different pace, perhaps, than in Estonia. And when I was in the US, I was working for a, while I was doing my MBA, I was working for a Silicon Valley startup. And, you know, there it's like 24/7. I think here in Estonia, we are a bit more still like to have a bit work-life balance. I could have a slightly slower pace, but I also think that's changing a little bit, particularly in the tech sector.
In which direction?
It's getting faster, I think.
In Estonia?
In Estonia as well, yeah. Especially okay. In the tech sector. And maybe this is a, you'll have to tell me if it's a tech versus talent thing as well. Maybe talent people
might
are
as well
more.
Be, might as well be. I mean, as you know, as a German, regarding the feedback thing, I've always been also appreciating, I mean, direct and honest feedback. And in my experience also from New Zealand, it's also this, as you said, you still give that feedback and you say you want to address issues, but you choose a different language. And it's then that type of direct or indirect language that everybody needs to understand, and sometimes, yeah, where we have to find each other.
Mm-hmm. All right. Lizeth, what would be your personal interest in forest or the goal of urbanics? Where do you see the current research of urbanics is going on? Is what are the projects currently going on in terms of problem solving, how you're solving those problems that you're facing, or what are the future goals of urbanics?
Absolutely. So I think one of the things we really want to do with urbanics is kind of take a lot of the, you know, the art and science of forestry that often sits in the heads of forest managers, and actually kind of translate it into hard data and work with scientists in doing that. So things like a lifelong forester has the ability to walk into a particular plot of land and they'll say, okay, I think this, you know, they'll stick their fingers in the soil and they'll go, this is great for birch. And we want to be able to do that based on data. So we've built the first version of that for our afforestation product. So that's about planting new forests. But really, we're super ambitious about bringing that kind of data-based, you know, scientific rigor to more broader forest management. So enabling landowners to have insights like that about their older established forests as well. So, for example, something that is, you know, very common across Scandinavia and the Baltics in forest management is clear cutting. And I know that different scientists have different views on this. And the reality is probably that it isn't a black or white topic. It's not, you know, you should never do it or you should always do it. But it's actually, it depends on the type of forest you have, the type of conditions you have. And we want to make that into, we want to basically build that into the data platform to be able to give that answer. Like, okay, on this plot of land, what you should be doing is just a very intensely managed commercial forest. And then this other plot of land that is adjacent, maybe here you should be thinking about doing a really long extended, you know, forest rotation. So waiting longer to harvest it. And this third plot, you should actually maybe do selective harvesting. And I think there's really cool opportunities here to kind of incorporate a lot of this research that's being done in Estonia, in Tartu University, and also in Maa Ülikool around these topics, and actually take a lot of this like scientific know-how and translate it into data and then translate it onto real plots in the real world and put it in the hands of those who actually manage it day by day, which is foresters.
Cool. You, I mean, I think that's well known. You're already expanding. You have partners in Finland and in Latvia. And obviously, you will have to incorporate also local knowledge from those areas, right? We would like to know how you maybe manage or develop that type of capability, like maybe internal training or partnering with, I don't know, local experts. And could you give us like an insight on how you manage that with Urbanics?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a careful balance. And what we've learned from, you know, being in markets now is for sure you can't go with the same approach to every market. That doesn't make sense. You have to take into account these nuances. For example, I think we found the soil data in Finland to be much harder to access than it was in Estonia. So there are these nuances. And I think a couple of things that have really helped us. So we have in-house, for example, our forestry expert who happens to be Latvian, which is very convenient. And so he does a lot of things like reaching out to some researchers at the Latvian Forest Agency and some local universities there to see what their latest research is and to access their data. And we've really found that this sort of commercial academic partnership model works out really well for us. And we're very excited to continue to do more of that. We think that's a great blueprint for making sure that the private sector is not, you know, off on its own doing something potentially harmful to the planet. So that's one piece. I think the other is really having that boots on the ground. So while our central team, we have our kind of headquarters in Tallinn, but we have a hybrid format. So some people work full-time remotely. But we make sure we have we have two people in Latvia, one person in Finland. And as we plan to expand to future markets, we will always make sure that we have one or two people on the ground who speak the language, who can get plugged into the local networks, you know, join the Forest Owners Association, etc. This stuff is really important to keep us up to date with what's happening.
Cool, thanks.
That's really nice. I wanted to ask you something else also, that, you know, we know that Nordics and Baltics, they are more, their geography has more forest land still compared to many parts of the world. How would you say Arbonix sees itself outside, working outside of these peripheries, so Nordic, Baltic, where deforestation is a major issue that people are facing? How does Arbonix see itself, probably in the future, of course, but working outside where deforestation is a major cause?
Yeah, absolutely. So we started in Europe and with a very strong European focus initially, also partially because we felt like the regulatory environment, so, you know, laws surrounding forestry were the strongest here. And obviously, it's the market we know best. I think long term, I'm definitely not ruling out expanding beyond Europe. We probably will consider it, but I think we'd have to be very careful because, again, you have a lot of regional differences. And so, you know, the reasons for deforestation in Brazil are very different from the reasons for deforestation in, I don't know, Chile. And you need to really understand the reasons, I think, to minimize it. And more broadly, I think the whole avoided deforestation section of the voluntary carbon market has been receiving a lot of criticism recently, some of it warranted, some of it slightly less warranted. But it's rightfully been pointed out that this is an extremely complex area where you have to be able to predict what the baseline trend would be. And you have to be able to kind of continue making sure that the plots you're protecting are actually protected legally and from illegal logging as well. And then you also have to have a very strong view of, like, how are you avoiding what's called leakage in the carbon world. So the idea of, okay, if I protect 100 hectares here in Brazil, am I losing the equivalent 100 hectares somewhere else in the world? And these are all extremely hard and thorny problems. And I think the biggest thing we've learned is really you have to go market by market, kind of bottom up, rather than trying to come up with one solution and apply it to the world. If you did that, you would fail. And we're sticking to what we know for now, which is Europe. But that's not to say we won't ever address those. There are some other interesting organizations working on some of the biggest deforestation areas in the world, and I think they're doing some really good work. And certainly, my hope is that area continues to evolve and get better.
So we saw that you wrote a very in-depth series of blog posts on the Arbonix website about the voluntary carbon market. Could you maybe give us, summary, more lightweight summary that we can convey here to the listeners?
Yeah, sure. I will try, and then jump in and tell me if what I'm saying is too detailed. But so high level carbon markets, people throw that phrase around a lot, and they're really talking about two different types of market. There's the compliance market and there's the voluntary market. Compliance market is, you know, the European Union countries trading quotas, etc. We don't touch that at all. We work entirely on the voluntary market. The voluntary market was born out of a desire that a lot of private companies had to essentially compensate for their CO2 footprint in some ways. And initially, it was born out of companies who made a plan. They said, okay, we're going to reduce our CO2 footprint, but we can't quite get it to zero. So we want to compensate by supporting projects in other parts of the world that are doing something to either remove CO2 from the atmosphere or avoid emitting it. And those are two different kind of subtypes of carbon credits. You can think of removal credits and avoided emissions credits. And the market, the voluntary carbon market, has been around for, you know, 30 plus years at this point. It certainly has been through its ups and downs. Historically, it was a little bit of a wild west for a lot of, I would say, low quality or no quality projects. But it's recently been receiving a lot more attention because I think more and more corporations are feeling the push from their stakeholders, whether it's employees or investors or anyone else, you know, just press to get more green. And often they turn to the voluntary market. I think the voluntary market has had some challenges that, conversely, the lowest quality supply is the easiest to generate, and vice versa. High quality supply is very difficult to create. And that means that a large amount of the market is full of what some people might call junk credits. I think what's changing, though, is there is more guidance coming out from big international organizations. Like the EU has recently introduced a framework for thinking about carbon removals, which touches on the voluntary markets and kind of defines what good quality looks like. So I'd say there's a lot of light in this tunnel towards the voluntary markets getting cleaned up. And I think secondly, a lot of people say, like, why do we even need these voluntary markets? And I'm a big believer that we actually do need them, and I will continue to need them more and more, because there is a limit to what we can achieve in climate change purely with laws, regulations, and banning stuff. You know, there's a point at which we need positive incentives for good behavior. And that's where voluntary markets and market structures can have a really good role, because governments only have a limited amount of money to play with. And they can't just go around banning everything, or their economies would crater. So we need some sort of like positive incentives that are coming from a non-government source. And I think that's where the voluntary market can have a strong role to play still.
Yeah, thanks.
So what would be your, say, personal outlook of the future of new forest economy? How does it look for you, that you see where this can go in future overall?
I mean, on a very personal level, I'm Estonian, which by nature kind of means that, you know, I grew up spending a lot of my spare time in the forest, picking berries, picking mushrooms, etc. That's a huge part of our culture and always has been. My British husband calls us forest-loving pagans, for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. So, you know, personally, I think I have this very selfish desire that I hope that, you know, the future children of our generation still get to enjoy nature the way that we get to enjoy it. And that means taking big steps today to keep that going. I think focusing in on the new forest economy in particular, I think we're really kind of at the beginning of this huge paradigm shift where people are starting to value nature more, and specifically understand that actually there is kind of a market value on it. So if you lose all nature, you're actually not just going to be sad, you're going to be out of a lot of food, clean water, building materials, etc. And so I think that is, some people think that it's bad to put a market value on something as intrinsically good as nature. I think it can be really helpful, because it means that we can clearly understand when we create damage, and we can tell people, like, this is what you're losing. And so, for example, the US is doing this huge program now where they actually are literally valuing their natural resources. You know, what is the value of clean drinking water and having adequate fish stocks and having, grasslands that are great landing places for birds? And so I think this is bringing with it this great awareness that it's really, really important to us all. And it will be increasingly important in a world in which we're adapting to climate change. And so I think my hope is that this all continues. And then secondly, my hope is that forest owners and landowners, who actually, you might be surprised, are extremely climate aware often, because they mm-hmm. see these minute changes, they really feel the impact of changing weather, for example, that we can really like bring them into the dialogue a bit more and bring them into the bigger picture, so that things like forestry regulation are not just decided by a bunch of people in suits sitting in an office somewhere, but we're actually incorporating the people who know the land the best, as well as incorporating really important perspectives from like scientists who work on the biology around it, etc. So those are my hopes. It's kind of all over the place, perhaps, but yeah. I guess it shows the size of the challenge.
I totally think that about this topic, we can, you know, like we can have literally several episodes just talking about this topic, and especially this nature evaluation. Estonia also just had a project, and the big presentation of more or less the, let's say, preliminary result was last week, the ELME 2 project, which basically this evaluate like four or five main landscapes, forests, grasslands, also wetlands, arable land in Estonia. And there was also the University of Tartu is also partner in this project. A couple of scientists are providing input. We're doing also some of the processing of the data. And even here we were also, there was also like one layer of the many was basically a supply demand modeling of people in the city, what's their reach, like how far they, you know, like in terms of travel isolines, how far they can reach within 1 hour or half an hour by car or by train or something, and which forests would they reach. And then there's like based on environment indicators, like mushrooms and berries, how suitable, like how likely are they to grow in this type of forest. And then so like you have like how well a forest would, you know, provide berries and mushrooms, and what's the pressure from the city. So in some areas you have less demand or less pressure. And so they were also like literally looking at those terms of economic modeling. So I think that is a whole topic by itself, and I think that is super interesting. I think we should go a little bit ahead, because we want to make sure that we can get also your advice. So for our, so we are the Department of Geography, and we do curriculums in geography and in GIS. So GIS more the geoinformatics, the sort of data and processing driven side of things. And we would like to ask from you, what type of advice would you give students, our students, let's say, GIS or geography students, and generally like enthusiasts in that space, on the way, in a few sentences, like to start off to be potentially as successful and impactful as you are?
I think one thing I always tell, you know, I've had interns for quite a few years that I've always mentioned this. What's amazing is that during your studies, you get to sample lots of things. And it's a great way to rule out what you don't like. Because in many ways in your career, the worst case scenario is, you know, locking yourself into something, and then you're 5 years in and you're like, my God, I hate this. So I always encourage students and young people to try as many different things as you can, so that you can rule out the things that don't work for you. And this is, you know, while you're doing your studies, no one will look weirdly if you do 1, 2, 3 month stints at different problems. And you're like 5 years into your career, this will start to look maybe not so good on your CV. So you want to do all your hopping around early on if you can. So that's one thing I would suggest. And the other is just, I think, you know, geography skills in particular are going to be super in demand. There's all these huge problems the world is grappling with, whether it's around, you know, mass migration of people or the changing landscapes due to climate change. Your skills are going to be so, so in demand. So you know, don't let anyone tell you that you should just switch over and study like front-end development or something. It's not true. We need a lot of different skill sets. We certainly need geographers.
Cool, thank you.
I have one fun question for you. Of course, you grew up in Estonia. I understand you have a lot of sentimental value to Estonian forest, with berry picking, mushroom picking, different activities related to forest. But if you have to say one forest area outside Estonia that fascinates you the most, what would it be?
Oh, I love this question. I recently found out that there is such a thing as temperate rainforest, and some of the only ones in the world are in the UK on the west coast. So you get a lot of, you know, it's a very sort of wet climate. And you get lots of really interesting mosses growing there. And ever since I found out about this, I am so curious, because I never thought you could find rainforest in Europe. And these are, like, technically they are rainforests. So I really, really want to go see that. I have not yet been to see it, but I hope to do it soon.
Cool, that's interesting.
Green forest, yeah.
By the way, I think I remember that sounds very much like the west coast of South New Zealand, where it's also super wet, but it's not tropical rainforest. Yeah. Sonia, you look like you want to ask something.
Yeah, I have a quick question. Like, so your education isn't philosophy, and you mentioned that how for us geographers, it's important to be confident about our skills and not be like, okay, you know, people are saying that, okay, we need more front-end developers and, you know, just jump to that. So I was just thinking that how your education has taught you, because philosophy is all about thinking why we do a certain thing. Whereas, like, I also feel sometimes when I meet people that they are not thinking why they are doing it, they are just doing it. So, like, do you, like, see that your education has trained you into, you know, thinking much deeper?
That's a good question. I would hope so. I don't know if it has taught me to think deeper. I do. So, I did economics, and it was philosophy for like interest in economics so that I would stand a chance of ever getting a job. So that was the balance. Everyone told me you would never get employed if you just study purely philosophy. Yeah. Jokes on them. Now in the era of AI, philosophers are more in demand than ever, actually.
Absolutely.
But I would say it has been super helpful, because one of the key things you learn in philosophy is to take an argument and actually break it down to its component parts, you know, understand what are the high kind of base assumptions and then how they lead to the conclusion. And that's always super helpful, no matter what problem you're solving, I think. And the other thing that philosophy teaches you is to do that in a way that's actually dispassionate towards the argument itself. You have to be able to sometimes argue both sides, and that can be valuable as well. It just helps you. It helps you maybe treat other people's arguments you may disagree with still with respect, or you at least understand, okay, you know, the reason they got to this conclusion is because they had these premises, and maybe one of the premises is wrong, but now I can empathize with why they reached a conclusion that otherwise might seem completely counter logical to me. So from that perspective, I think it's been helpful, and the ability to read really long and possibly boring texts as well can be really helpful.
Awesome. Yeah, I think I can relate. All right then, and thank you so much for your time, Lizette.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been fun. Thank you guys for the conversation, and good luck with your new ones that are coming up now that you're kicking off your new season.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. Dear listeners, this concludes our episode today. Like everywhere, please like, share, and subscribe. We'd also be happy if you have some feedback for us. See you in the next episode.